KZSU, Stanford University, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I'm really thrilled and honored to have the opportunity to have a wonderful guest on today, someone who I'm really honored to have on the show, as his writing has influenced not only me, but countless lawyers and academics who have considered a wide variety of legal issues over the last 40 years. I'm very pleased to have on Professor Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago School of Law today, discussing among, you know, he could pretty much discuss virtually any issue that I raise, but we're going to focus today in particular on intellectual property, and particularly the fact that he has written a study for the Manufacturing Institute called Intellectual Property for the Technological Age. As everyone knows who's listened to this show regularly, intellectual property is an area that I focus on, and it's also an area of immense interest because it's a very, very fluid area of law right now with respect not only to technology, but generally the endeavor of creation and discovery. And although Hearsay Culture focuses heavily on technology, occasionally we do have the opportunity to discuss the law in more detail and really take advantage of the wonderful people that are at Stanford and spend time at Stanford. And so to that extent, we are very lucky and fortunate to have Professor Epstein here today to chat with us. Very, very brief introduction because I want to get to Professor Epstein. He is a James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago and is the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and as of 2007 a visiting professor of law at NYU Law School. His accolades are many. Suffice to say he is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's written countless books, many of the listeners to this show have listened to. I was rereading Simple Rules for a Complex World over the last couple of weeks, based upon discussion that Richard had with many of the fellows at Stanford Law School not too long ago. But his resume is endless. Suffice to say that his writing has influenced a broad range of areas, from constitutional law to law and economics to intellectual property, tort law, you name it. So I'm very, very excited to have Professor Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago and the Hoover Institution on today. So I'm going to dispense with my usual dialogue or monologue, I should say, with regard to why we're chatting today, go to a short music break, and return with Professor Richard Epstein on Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford. Richard, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, it's very glad to be here.
Let's jump right in. For the uninitiated, for people listening to Hearsay Culture who are not attorneys or haven't focused on the law that heavily, your background and your general view on regulation and law and economics.
Well, that's a small question. We could do the whole hour on it,
exactly,
I suppose. But,
exactly.
I mean, my background in terms of origins is I was raised in New York City, went to Columbia University, and then I started my study of law at Oxford University in England and came back to finish up at Yale, and then went right into teaching, so I'm a lifer. And the English education, I think, had a lot to do with this, because even though England is generally thought to be a fairly left-wing country, certainly in the 1960s when I was there, the fellows I studied in the law school tended to be 19th-century judges of a very classical liberal orientation, and I have to say that they generally persuaded me that they were right and the rest of modern society was wrong. And so I basically have gone through life more or less as a contrarian, much more devoted to the principles of James Madison on constitutionalism and Adam Smith on economics than to anything associated with the progressive era, the New Deal, legal realism, and the like. So I'm a throwback and proud of it. I regard this as the most sophisticated position in terms of a modern point of view. I regard the adversaries as people who essentially mired in much more primitive forms of economic and philosophical discourse. So now that's the basic sort of hype. Now the question is, what does all this entail? And I always think that Aaron Director, of blessed memory, put it very nicely when he said, if you're dealing with political institutions, examine all new laws under a presumption of error. And what he meant by that, in effect, was to say, any legal system is going to have a certain degree of drag by virtue of the fact that all legal systems, when they introduce new laws, have administrative costs that are capable of making errors. So if you know that those two things are around, you want to be reasonably confident that you know what you're trying to do and you want to stop certain activities from taking place. And here, essentially, within the classical liberal framework of which I'm a part, number one item for which you think that you can meet this burden and rather handily do it is to control the use of force. And that's not going to be a big issue with respect to intellectual property. The very name itself suggests that muscles aren't at stake.
Well, at least we hope they won't be.
Well, we hope they won't be. Self-help is not a powerful remedy of violence, although it is with property, of course. Mm-hmm. The second thing, of course, is that to control force, you have to have a coherent system of property rights, which means that you have to be able to figure out what things belong in the commons and what things go private. And on that issue, my Roman law background has always been heavily influential, because when Justinian starts, he starts with the common, doesn't talk obviously about intellectual property, but makes it very clear that private property is limited to land and chattels, slaves and animals in his case. We don't like the slavery stuff too much today, I hope. But you can see where he was coming from. And then what happens is, if you've got this property, the next thing you've got to do is to find out how it is that you could combine and reuse it, along with the labor that people have, the rights in their own bodies. And that means you have to have a law of contract, which is pretty robust. And the thing which I think becomes most relevant to the intellectual property debate is, if you start with Adam Smith, you are deeply suspicious of state monopolies. Mm-hmm. And you also understand that there are at least some circumstances in which private monopolies can arise by various kinds of circumstances, and we'll have to at least entertain the unhappy prospect that some form of regulation in those areas may be no form at all. So essentially what happens is, if you start looking at the world in the way in which I do, the control of force, the protection of property, the protection of violation of voluntary exchange, and the willingness to entertain certain kinds of anti-monopoly regulations, either through direct rate controls or through some kinds of an antitrust or competition policy, is the sum of all wisdom with respect to regulation.
The and you have said so much there that we could basically say thank you for being here.
I'm happy to have been on the show.
But all of those issues, especially cut with you know, ultimately with the question of where we are with intellectual property, because of the regulatory aspect of it and the absence of force, yeah, in the traditional sense. The question you mentioned earlier, and I do want to probe it a little bit before we get into IP particularly, which is your focus on English law and on the common law,
yeah,
system. And you benefited the fellows at Stanford with some of your thoughts on that. Perhaps you could drill down on a little bit to this extent. We don't often, at least in this century, in yeah, you know, since 2000 or probably earlier, read things like Maitland's History of English Law. And perhaps we should. And for those people who are looking at intellectual property issues, but more broadly, technology, we think of technology as something that somehow is reinventing all that has been thought before. And we know that that isn't the case. What would be your pitch to the technologists, to the people who view themselves as being on the cutting edge of whatever legal issues are kicking in technology, and their response to, why should I read Maitland's History, which is 100, you know, over 100 years old and what have you?
Well, first of all, he's a smart guy with immense sophistication, and you may not want to read all of it, obviously, and so forth, but essentially, I think that the correct way to understand intellectual property is through a series of rather well-pointed analogies to the physical space. And if you go back and you understand the various evolution of property rights, the relationship between the commons with certain kinds of resources and privatization of property, and you see how that played out in physical areas, it's going to give you a real hand up in trying to figure out how you do it with respect to intellectual property. So, I mean, what I think is that, to put it in another way, the modern lawyer, when he's trying to argue an IP case, if he talks about infringement, he's going to have to analogize it to trespass and so forth. If he's going to talk about fair use, he ought to know something about the traditional law of privileges, which allow people to abridge liberty and property. The more you have a secure grasp of the way in which these things played out in other contexts in earlier ages, the better you'll do in this particular arena. So let me give you an illustration of something which I think really helps. We had historically a rule called the ad coelum rule, which meant that he who owns the surface of the land owns up to the heavens. Then technology comes along in the form of airplanes, and all of a sudden we now have to figure out what to do with overflight. And yes, when we look at it, we could apply this rule, and if transactions cost were zero, everybody who flies across the ocean, or not across the ocean, over the United States, would pay maybe 300,000 landowners per trip going back and forth a toll equal to a fraction of a penny in order to use these things. And we realized that the blockades made no sense. So what we did is we created a different system of property rights in the upper atmosphere. And it's very nice, although I won't go into it now, how you manage to do this constitutionally, given that you have protection of property rights. But the clear implication of this from a political point of view, is that if you can see vast social improvements in the Pareto sense, everybody being made better off and nobody being made worse off, then in effect you'll be willing to do that through coercive government action. And the IP space is like that. I mean, essentially, to understand the way intellectual property works, what you have to do is to imagine a space in the center, a circle, as it were, which is the commons. And that includes standard mathematical theorems. It includes ordinary English language. It includes general physical laws of one kind or another. And then around it, what we tried to do is to say, if we privatize in one of these areas, can we preserve what is important about the commons, that is, the way in which it creates essentially an ease of communication between individuals with almost zero transactions cost? Can we find around that certain particular areas in which privatization will produce gains in terms of invention and innovation that will pay for themselves and for the administrative cost to running the system?
Right.
Because one of the things that we always have to remember is that you cannot, no matter how ardent your socialism, redistribute the benefit of technologies that we do not possess. So you, in order to redistribute, you got to have. In order to have, what you have to do is to reward the inventors. So what you need to do, therefore, is to figure out where do you want to go around this thing. And it turns out the way I teach intellectual property is I go area by area and I go around the periphery. And so, in effect, you know, what's the difference between a physical law on the one hand and an algorithm on the other? Well, you better know a little bit about mathematics, and then you could start talking about the outer limits of what counts as a process, for example, under the law of patents, the so-called doctrines of patent eligibility.
Right.
And then, on the other hand, somebody has an ordinary word like monopoly, which describes a certain economic relationship, and then somebody comes up with a very clever board game. And you can say, well, we're going to allow you to patent the name monopoly, but we'll be darned if you're going to have to be able to charge or be able to charge a royalty to every professor in every economics book from the beginning of time.
Right.
And so you must develop a doctrine of secondary meaning, which allows you to use the name for which you want strong identification rights, as opposed to the term for which essentially you want to keep it in the commons. So you got a secondary that goes up there.
Yeah.
With things like trade secrets, and they're very tricky because if you invent the recipe and you put it in your drawer, you know, you've got a trade secret unless somebody happens to invent it themselves. And generally, the legal system has made the right rule on that, which is if I want to keep something secret, I can keep it secret. But I can't tell anybody else if he thinks of the same recipe that he can't use it. Mm-hmm. For that, I got to go back to the patent system, assuming that some protection is there. And then once you have this kind of a system, you're going to have to figure out exactly how they are lost, what kind of imitation is permissible, and so forth. You got a third body of law out there. Copyrights, well, that's easy. I mean, I want to write something and stick it in the drawer. It seems pretty clear that I own the paper. It also seems pretty clear that nobody could copy it if nobody can see it. But the moment I publish it, if everybody else can copy it, then you have the situation where the creator is going to be the high-cost producer of his own good,
right,
and all the competitors will be low-cost producers, so you start giving protection. Now, in this case, I think the protection that's given is much too long in recent days, and I would blame the EU as much as I would blame the United States, but in general, maybe 14 years is too short, maybe 28 years is about right, but much over 35 or 40 years, frankly, my dear, I don't see it, and the peculiar and ridiculous arguments made by authors that what should happen is that they should basically be able to give their patent protection or the copyright protection for their own lives and the lives of their children and their grandchildren is nuts. We have very efficient capital markets today. You could take any stream of income over any period of years and put it into a corpus and then take it out in the form of another stream of income over another stream of years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everybody else gets paid $1 million for a wonderful idea. They can annuitize it if they want, and I don't see why it is that we should say only authors are not supposed to go to the capital markets to figure out how to regulate their flow on wealth. So, I mean, that's a classic illustration of the kinds of crazy abuses you could get in the intellectual property area.
Right.
And what one has to be aware of, and I'll stop the point.
No, please.
what one has to be aware of is that you don't, in this area, win the day by simply making an existence proof that one of these major areas of intellectual property is required.
Mm-hmm.
What you then have to do is the very hard work of figuring out how much of this particular area you want and can tolerate, when is enough, when is too much, when it is that, in fact, it's too little. And I've just given you the too much illustration. I might as well keep going.
Sure. I will jump in because I do want to come back to the duration question.
Okay.
But
here's a case in which I think the protection is too short. I mean, I have, full disclosure, worked extensively on pharmaceutical issues with pharmaceutical companies and with pharma. What happens is the standard utility patent for a drug is 20 years, of which you can now spend easily 10 or 12 or 14 years tied up in the FDA on approval process. So you have the exclusive right to sell, but you have no right to sell because the patent law doesn't let you escape other regulatory agencies.
Mm-hmm.
The Hatch-Waxman Act in 1984 gives you back about 2.5 years at the end of the term for any 5 years that are lost in front of the abyss known as the FDA. That's not enough at this point. So when you're talking about putting in on average $1 billion for a drug, having to wait 10 or 12 years before it gets to market, 9 years or 10 years or 11 years for recoupment is too short.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have to do is to figure out how it is that we lengthen the thing. And oddly enough, if you lengthen the patent protection, there will be subtle pressures on the FDA to speed up their processes because everybody will say, gee, we don't want to wait that much longer for the drugs to become generic.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a case in which you have two duration questions, one going wildly long and the other one going moderately short. And it seems to me that we could make a fairly substantial improvement in the system if we were able to trim back both of them in the appropriate direction.
The issue of intellectual property duration, of course, is a hot one.
Mm-hmm.
And, the disclosure that I don't have to give you and certainly listeners know is that, I work for the Center for Innovative Society. We're
dangerous operation, yes.
Yes, we're all subversives, and we're trying to undermine the property system. I'm kidding, of course. But one of the cases that I know you're familiar with is a case that Professor Lessig handled in Eldred v. Ashcroft, where the challenge was essentially to the duration of copyright. Right. And I think for many people, it may be counterintuitive to hear you say that the duration of copyright is too long. Although, from a perspective of regulation, we're dealing with life plus 70 years. We're dealing with a situation where the dead are able to capitalize on their creation, where they captured the wealth decades earlier. But I want to actually, it's a weird position for me to be in, to push back on that, even though at the disclaimer, of
Keep
course,
pushing.
Is that I agree. I actually agree that duration is too long. But you do hear people on the other side of the equation say this. If you think that it's too long, you don't understand how things are made today, and that the fees that are collected today fund the creations today, so that the stream of revenue is needed to continue the creative endeavor. If I created something in 1920 and I own the copyright and I'm getting royalties today, or admittedly there isn't a lot of that, then I'm actually funding and incentivizing the creation today that will lead to further streams.
That's crazy.
Yeah, your response?
First of all, in terms of this thing, I was on the Copyright Term Extension Act even before Lessig got interested in this thing. Let's just keep the priorities straight. I did something in 1998 for the Wall Street Journal, which made it pretty clear that I thought that this was a giant grab on the commons.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is a kind of situation in which junk science with respect to the idea of how venture capital works is there. There is nothing which says that the capital for tomorrow's venture has to come from today's venture. Let us assume that you've got a venture that's going to pay a rate of return that's sufficient to attract capital. The entire world is willing to march in. I mean, I would bet right now if you try to figure out the percent of total new ventures that are funded by the revenues from old ventures, it would be probably under 1%. I mean, most of this money comes in from new people. The inventors who've retired and put their money in trust will take that money and they'll invest it in a way that optimizes family returns. So, mm-hmm. All one has to do in order to make sure this goes is that the future is right. You don't have to confer windfalls on the past. All that does is change all the people who've got the money so that different folks will make the investment. It has zero effect on what the total level of investment would be, except that it's negative in this extent. To the extent that you give a free monopoly and you reduce the total output of goods and services, you make the nation marginally poorer than it was before, which means there's a little bit less for venture capital as there is for everything else. So that's not a pushback. One of the things that has to remember is that the standard rules of finance apply to this area as they apply to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the strong themes about my own intellectual development, if you go back and re-listen to the earlier remarks, is that it's perfectly general in its application. Anytime somebody mentions the favor that there's a special circumstance in this industry, my view is you're always wrong. The number of special pleas that ought to be honored is virtually zero. And if we keep that in mind, then when we start to hear these complaints from the heart, what we will generally do is to soundly reject them. And, you know, look, go back to Adam Smith, my hero of the day, and one of his basic reactions has always been, you know, all sorts of people will talk about special circumstances to protect infant industries against foreign competition by the use of tariffs. And, of course, all those arguments are in principle right, in the sense that you could imagine a one in a billion possibility where you're better off with protection than without it. But generally, you got to play the odds in an ex-ante world, and if those odds are a billion to one, I know which way I'm going to come out with respect to the question. And so we've had this history with respect to why agriculture is special, and we get price supports. We've had this history with rent, why it is rent control, or apartments are special, and we get rent control. And all you do in these markets is create distortions. If you keep a strong system of property rights, but know what its limits are, then you have to ask this question. Why are intellectual property rights not in perpetuity? And there's a reason for that. With land, you have your cake and you eat it too. If you give a sole owner, in effect, you will get first efficient deployment of the resources over the long haul and efficient consumption. With IP, if you want to get the right incentive to produce, it turns out that since information is portable, you're going to have underconsumption at the back end. So there's a trade-off there. And the question is just where do you draw those lines? I think everybody agrees copyrights ought to be longer than patents, because patent technology essentially is something which in the ordinary course of business will be replicable. Whereas if I happen to write "You're All Shook Up," nobody's going to come up with that song for a very long time. And so therefore it blocks very few things on the one hand, and it keeps its distinctive value for a longer period of time. But longer than 20 years doesn't necessarily mean 120 years. It could easily be that the patents are about right. And as I said, with intellectual property, I sort of double the money and give it a 40-year thing insofar as we're concerned with copyrights.
The study that you did touches on a number of issues, and I do want to probe some of them because I actually, you know, I read your work in law school. I even read your work before I went to law school.
Oh my God!
I was one of those scary kids who actually was, you know, people wondering what I was doing all day carrying these books around. But I do want to ask you about some of the ideas that you identify in the study and see where you come down. One of the fascinating areas, as you know, in copyright law is the issue of fair use. And it's a subject of a lot of litigation, and, you know, and indeed CIS has a fair use project now. And so it's a lot of interesting, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. You mentioned the issue of the anti-commons, which I'll actually ask you to define for the listeners in a moment, because it's kind of a strange term. But the question I want to follow up on is the issue of documentary filmmakers. And there are situations where, in fact, the fair use exception, that is the exception that allows for a commentary and et cetera and so forth, in fact, isn't operating the way the statute would suggest it would. And one of the areas is the issue of documentary filmmakers who are seeking to ultimately either do a story that's going to be unflattering to a particular entity that holds a right, or in the case of the Eyes on the Prize PBS story, where there's so much music that the Eyes on the Prize show being a documentary about the civil rights movement, and the music associated with that documentary is also subject to a permission system. And indeed, the inability to get all the permissions has ultimately kept Eyes on the Prize from being disseminated, at least recently, because there was a limited license issued.
Yeah.
My question is, really, as an example, but the larger question is, don't we have an anti-commons problem in the issue and in relation to documentary filmmakers and fair use?
Well, the answer to that question is yes. My son is a documentary filmmaker in Todd Time, so I'm well aware of some of these difficulties. But let's go back to the beginning and see if we could keep this in proportion and then figure out what to do. First of all, what's the definition of the anti-commons? This is a term which basically became popular only about 10 years ago in an article that was written by a law professor named Michael Heller, and later brought into the IP area when he combined with an intellectual property professor known as Rebecca Reisenberg. I mean, known as, that was her name, actually. And essentially what happens is the anti-commons is designed to sort of replicate the tragedy of the commons. And the tragedy of the commons occurs when there's a lot of fish in a pool. None of them is owned, and so each hunter or each fisherman takes out more than he should, or more than he would if he were the sole owner of the particular herd, which leads to its premature extinction. And so what you need to do is to either privatize the commons, which is very difficult with respect to fish that go back and forth across national boundaries, or impose various kinds of government regulations that limits the size of the catch for a sustainable yield. The anti-commons is the opposite. That's a system in which there's a fragmentation of property rights so that so many people can blockade the use of a particular resource that nobody will be able to use it effectively. And the illustration I gave, for example, of the air rights in the airplane is a classic illustration of a series of multiple blockades that essentially is overridden by a government fiat, justified in this particular case, to say the upper airspace is now common property and the property rights in it in terms of travel will be established by the FAA with respect to its safety rules. Mm-hmm. And so essentially all that Heller and Eisenberg were worried about were excessive blockades. Now the question is, how do we know when there's a blockade? Well, a lot of it depends upon the topology of the landscape if you're looking at physical resources, and the same thing will happen with respect to intellectual property. So just to take the general question, let's start with this as a background on the tech side before we get to the documentary film.
Mm-hmm.
Do we think that the addition of any new patent in any particular area is going to increase or reduce the blockade effect of other patents? And the answer to that question is, frankly, my dear, we don't know in the abstract, but the betting would be that the more patents you have, the fewer the blockades. Now, why is that? If you imagine these things as being in an array, suppose you have to go through six steps in order to get a process. And at every one of these steps, you get four alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's what's happening, you've got a lot of choices at each stage, and you'll be able to bargain off one against another and presumably find the path through this thicket. Somebody comes up with a new invention. Now, instead of having four alternatives at the first stage, you may have five.
Okay.
Or you'll get a new invention, which means that you don't have to bargain with anybody at stages six or seven.
Mm-hmm.
And if that guy comes in with a blockbuster patent, he will not be able to charge more than the old six and seven combination could have been able to do. And if he's really good, somebody else is going to come in that same field because the patent doesn't give you a monopoly over the functionality as such, only the device of the invention that allows you to actualize that formality. I mean, that's not 100% correct, but it's 95%
right.
correct
okay. yeah.
for these particular points.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Morse could patent the telegraph. He mm-hmm. could not get control over all uses of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Right.
So new inventions in the tech area generally seems to me to expand possibilities by giving you alternative stepping stones through the thicket. Now, the documentary filmmaker is a very different guy. I mean, there is no way, to give your example, that a very clever new song will replace We Shall Overcome when it comes to the question of how you do a sort of a historiography of the civil rights period. I mean, it was there. If you put this other music in, people will start calling you of basically somebody who's a fraudulent manipulator of past history
mm-hmm.
to do this. So the supply side situations are completely different, which means that the guys who have that stuff have got it really. In addition, we also know there's a very strong tradition out there which says that news is something for which there is no intellectual property protection.
Right.
So, I mean, the standard case having to do with this was the so-called INS case, and that said that you may not be able to copy somebody's reports or even use the information to write your own reports in the short run, but the actual content of the stories, you know, who won the Battle of the Marne, is going to be open to everybody to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the reasons why we get a little bit uneasy about any copyright protection with the civil rights movement is we're not quite sure when we're playing We Shall Overcome whether that's history or whether that's broadcast.
Right.
And I would, in effect, treat it to some extent as part of a slightly different version of a fair use exception, which is a reportorial exception, which is very similar with respect to the documentary historian to that of the newspaper broadcaster or mm-hmm. the telephone or the media broadcaster. There's no question, for example, that if you were at the time and somebody was singing We Shall Overcome at this, you know, the steps of the Washington Monument on Martin Luther King's great speech, that somebody would be able to say, can't put that on the air because it turns out now that we've got ourselves a situation in which we have copyright protection with respect to the song and you don't fall within the designated fair use stuff because you're trying to report on the event, you're not trying to comment on it.
Right.
So the first thing I would say is I think that the definitions of fair use with respect to documentaries are wrong. And, well, then the next question is, well, just how far do you go? Well, if this is my basic solution, if mm-hmm. in fact what you're trying to do here is to take a pastiche of all songs, and you could be reasonably confident that none of them are going to be broadcast as separate songs as such
mm-hmm.
or advertised as such, then you just use it. And I would frankly not worry about the payment because this would be my reaction, is if there was a world with no payment, would, and I just had the right to veto or to allow the inclusion of my song in the documentary. That is, I could not by law extract the prize for it. I'd put it in.
Right.
And the reason I'd put it in is, hey, they're hearing snippets of this over the background. Wouldn't you like to get a nice crystalline recording of Joan Baez singing this song instead of listening to a bunch of throaty people manage to mangle the music? I'm sure you'd want to do that. Maybe not the only thing, but it certainly would be something that's there. So one of the things that we know about intellectual property is that the return flows from public use are often positive to private holders. And to put it in slightly different language, the taking that exists by forcing this copyright into the public domain is offset by the just compensation you get from the increased sales of the particular product in question. So, you know, this won't happen in every case,
right,
but it's certainly one that will work. Well, somebody said, why not negotiation?
Yeah.
Well, we know what the answer to that is.
Yeah.
It's that you've got to negotiate with 80 different people, each of whom thinks that his song is worth 4% of the value of the total package. Well, you do the multiplication, and it turns out that the royalties exceed the yield, and the whole thing gets scrapped. Now, maybe you don't need to do this incident. You could do that incident, although that's kind of hard because you're talking about defined historical spaces. But if you lose, we shall overcome. You've not done a history of the civil rights movement. It just doesn't read the same way. So in that case, I think you're right. And this starts to illustrate another point of great moment in importance with the IP generally, which is how do you decide to make not a IP regime,
right,
but multiple IP regimes to take into account different forms of intellectual property that work within different spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And this could even happen within given areas. For example, I have zero sympathy in the copyright area for somebody who says, you know, the civil rights movement is really very important, so I can play Joan Baez's song anytime I want and not pay her a royalty.
Right.
I mean, that's got to be wrong on the other side of this thing. So you'd like to see them work this out. There's also another problem here, and it ties in with the long copyright problem, and it's a problem that Lessig and I actually agree on again, so let it be understood. And that's one of the problems associated with orphan works.
Mm-hmm.
One of the real difficulties is that as copyrights are owned privately and they start to get transferred, in some cases, God forbid, are inherited or put into trust, you don't even know who owns the darn thing.
Right.
And so even if you're willing to pay a royalty or a compulsory royalty, you have no idea whom to pay it too. And so now you're told that you could broadcast this thing, and once you do it, the great-grandchild is going to come out of the woodworks and seek to enjoin the entire publication, and you can't even negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need to do is two things. One is you've got to shorten the basic term again, because if it's down to 40 years, by the way, just think of it. Very conveniently, the civil rights movement for these purposes ended around 1968, 1969.
Mm-hmm.
You're out from under. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with all the stuff that took place before 1960.
Right.
Nothing that exists with respect to the Rosa Parks incidents and the Montgomery strikes would be covered by it. So that's the first thing that you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing you want to do, I think, is probably develop what I would call a put-up-or-shut-up regime. And that is, what you say to people is, you've got some of this property. Most of the stuff has only blocking value and doesn't have use value. You want to protect it. Here's a registry. And what you do is you go to this particular registry and you say, I am the owner of XYZ pieces of intellectual property. And anyone who wants to use this, they now know whom to negotiate. This is my email address and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then within 90 days after that's posted, anyone could come up and challenge the designation of ownership. And if necessary, you could either resolve it by agreement or by litigation. I'm a little bit leery about having private settlements for doing it, because it may well be that X owns it, but Y and Z are fighting, and they'll decide between themselves that they both own it. But in the end, if X could come in and make his claim at the same time, maybe you want to do that. At that point now, what I would then do is to say that if you have multiple claimants of a single piece, what they have to do is to designate a single person who will negotiate for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then that person, when he negotiates the deal, gets a fee for services and divides the proceeds pro rata in accordance with interest. And so what you can do then is create a voluntary market by putting all of these interests behind a trust. And you ask, well, where did I get this idea from? English Settled Land Act of 1926. That's what they did with respect to divided interest in real property, except for leases and with respect to reversions, interest over the weeks. But life estates, contingent remainders, all behind the trust. The stranger only deals with the trustee. So going back to the original point,
yep,
if you know these older systems and you know them well, you'll do a lot better with the IP world than if you'd never heard of them.
It is the best pitch that I've heard so far for reading that far back. And I do want to.
Wait, 1926.
Well, it's pretty far back.
Well, you got to go back. You should really understand the 1880 acts as well, but that's a different problem.
We're going to take a short music break and then come back. I do want to piggyback off your point with regard to net benefits for industry as well as for those seeking to circumscribe copyright protection with respect to the Google Book Search project.
Ah, yes. And so which I've written.
Exactly. And so we will jump into that. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU. After a short music break, we'll return with Professor Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago and the Hoover Institution here at Stanford on KZSU. We're going to return with Professor Epstein in a moment, but before we do, we're now in the time of the show where I ask you for money in a direct pitch. The quickest way to get money is to simply ask you and see if you'll give it to us. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial station and requires listener donations to continue the great sports, music, news, and other programming on KZSU. If you're interested in learning more about making a donation to KZSU, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And hopefully, at that point, you will get a response, and I do ask you to keep listening to KZSU. We're back with Professor Epstein, and I started with Sting's If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free, and Jackson Browne's Boulevard, and there was Living on a Thin Line by the Kinks, which actually commenting on Old England. And if we kept going on the song, there's some interesting parallels. But I do want to jump in on the Google Book Search project, which is another controversial project, and something that you wrote about in this report as well. Well, again, we have this issue of less rights ultimately benefiting both the creator and the disseminator, as it were. And I was interested to find that you, in fact, were a bit sanguine on the positions taken by authors in that situation. Now, you mentioned earlier before the break your view on duration. But I'm curious to get your view on the Google Book Search project and where it comes down.
I mean, it's the split. If you have a shorter copyright period, this problem largely disappears. But think about this in contrast with the situation in the documentary films. The Google search requires at a minimum that Google make at least two fresh, mint, complete copies of the entire work, which it could then archive and put up snippets from which it will then be able to derive revenues. Mm-hmm. This is not a situation in which you're trying to run a pastiche of little bits and pieces of hundreds of songs in order to put back a documentary. These are works which often have present commercial life, and they have authors and publishers who are capable of negotiating as a unified team with respect to Google over a comprehensive division of the royalty rights. So my own attitude about this is that with the old stuff, where I think the value is negligible, the washout I think is really correct. And, you know, you take a book written in 1947, which has sold 14 copies in the last 9 years and is still under copyright, and you put it on Google, my guess is that paying nothing to these authors is a boon because they will get more attention for their work and more royalties for their descendants than if they had kept it off the system. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's nothing about this program which archives old stuff. The mission of Google is to organize the world's information, and that means stuff which came out a year or two or three ago, which are under active management with potentially very powerful sales, with all sorts of reuse rights in movies and in other kinds of broadcasts and so forth. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it seems to me you really want to go back to the voluntarist model of private transactions. So basically, I think that time is a pretty good surrogate for the things for which you would put into the library and the things not. The other thing, of course, is that if you put this into a library on a mandated basis, Google can certainly run this, but there's nothing which says that the state shouldn't attach a modest compulsory royalty stream to it, non-negotiable by anybody, mm-hmm. so that some portion of the rents that come from the revitalization go to Google. Now, how should that be divided? Well, this is a classic joint cost problem. Google without the novels doesn't have anything to print, and the novels without Google don't have any ways to reach their audience. So it's a classic situation where, like love and marriage, you can't have one without the other. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's the situation, then an arbitrary division done once and for all by a kind of a mandate after a commission reviews this based upon what these licensing rates would be in a voluntary market is not a bad way to go. Mm-hmm. And, one of the irony about this is that why is Google worth billions? It's because they are the masters at differential pricing with respect to advertisements. You want to click on a site that has to do with asbestos, you pay $40, right, mm-hmm. if you happen to be the guy. If it's something which happens to do with the Philatelic Society, you may pay 4 cents. If these guys can work the most incredible forms of differentiated pricing with respect to the things they sell, I don't think they should be able to turn around and say that there's only one price that works for the things that we buy, and that turns out to be $0.00.
The book project also touches on something else that in the remaining about 13 minutes that we have on the show, I want to get your quick responses to a few other interesting issues that are kicking up right now, which another one being open source and the open source movement. That's not new, but clearly as companies like Microsoft seek to go a little bit in the open source direction, there's a question of why that's happening. And I'm curious to get your view as open source as a form of regulation. You discuss it as being a parallel to copyright law. And for people listening to the show, the open source idea basically is an idea that allows for the source code and what have you of a program to be widely disseminated absent a rights system, except with respect to how it's disseminated and the rights that attach, which are different than copyright. So I'm gonna ask you the question this way. Is the open source system a form of regulation? And if so, how strong a regulation do you think it is?
Well, I don't think it's a form. I think it's a form of private regulation. And therefore, the one risk about it is when they keep on imposing these conditions further and further down the line, there will be some question at some point in the line as to whether or not some antitrust kinds of implications go there. I would resist that. But let me start from mm-hmm. the beginning and give you a comparison to the Creative Commons license, which essentially is the sort of thing which the Center for Internet and Society is in favor of, mm-hmm. and which is joined with Microsoft with respect to making it easier for people to issue those licenses on various kinds of Microsoft operating systems.
And under which this show is actually disseminated as a podcast.
And which with my blessing on this show. There are other things for which I would have a different view on the finances, I suppose, like books you publish and casebooks in particular.
Right.
I don't want open source casebooks. But the situation is as follows. A license does not impose upon the owner of a property, a license system, that is, a duty to make money. If somebody thinks that the dissemination of the information as a soft benefit to them exceeds the cash revenues that they would otherwise get, under any licensing system, they should be able to do that. And I will tell you, once I was asked to write on some problem having to do with property rights, and the offer came as follows. Dear Professor Epstein, we would like you to write this article for our particular conference and journal, but we want you to understand in this thing that you are entitled to take this article without our notice or permission and to sell it or to redistribute it under any circumstances at any time. God bless you. What was going on in this particular case? They wanted to use a front-end payment in order to get me to write it, and then they wanted to have the right to distribute it, but their attitude was, hey, if he could distribute this widely and get paid by somebody else to do it or just distribute it widely for further publicity to him, it's all going to redound to our benefit. So, frankly, that's what we would like to do.
Right.
And as we know, there are many websites that measure their success not in royalties obtained for the work that's provided. They measure their success in hits obtained, that is, the number of people who basically consume their goods for free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just simply because of vanity, although that's certainly a part of it, but it's also because in the great world of ideas, we all understand that power is shaped by influence, and that influence requires the dissemination of information. And so what we do is we have powerful think tanks supported by various kinds of sort of publicly minded individuals, including the Internet for, you know, the Center for Internet and Society, mm-hmm. who basically believe that investing in you for free dissemination is a good use of their money. Well, you know, I'm with them. And if you go back and you check the kind of classical liberal constraints on this system, you will see that every one of them is conformed with perfectly. Mm-hmm. There is nobody here is using stuff that was created by nobody else. All the licenses essentially are in the form which says this is what you have to do, and there are conditions. Like, mention my name, please, when you use my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a very important condition. That's the vanity press rule. And, in fact, it's also important for listeners. You want to know who says something because it will influence the weight and the attention and the time that you'll give to it. If it's somebody you really hate, off it goes. If it's somebody you love, you read it twice.
So, hence the name Hearsay Culture.
Okay. And that's exactly what this business is about. Now, open source, to my mind, nothing goes in the public domain under open source. If it went into the public domain, somebody could then put it into their own thing and basically take that and privatize it and sell it. What the open source people want to do is to essentially have a kind of a genetic system in which once something starts as open source, anything that incorporates it remains as open source. And, you know, within the limits of the system, why not? Now, there are kind of tricky questions here. If somebody incorporates this by mistake into a private program, getting it perhaps from a source that he didn't realize was an open source, do they have to dismantle the entire thing or make the whole thing go? Well, this is going to be basically a kind of a reverse problem that you often get with respect to computer software patents. And let me sort of explain the situation.
Yeah, please.
You want to run a system in which you put together a complicated thing like a telephone. And it's got a complicated chip. Well, the basic rule on chips, so I've been told, is that you cannot make a chip which does not at some point infringe some copyright or some patent. Well, the copyright you may be able to avoid by not copying, but the patents you can't. And why is that? Well, it's the law of large numbers. You've got, you know, several hundred thousand or several million lines of code. Some of them are going to look very much like something which somebody patented which you didn't see.
Right.
Well, do we allow you to shut down the entire system because it's got the two lines of code in it? And the answer that everybody says is, wait, that's got to be crazy, even if you're a believer in strong property rights. Sure, you give a compulsory license, although I wouldn't do it for very much. And sure, you may say in the future, please design another chip which doesn't have those two offending lines. You may do that. But this is a situation where if you build, to use a real property example, you've now managed to build an entire metropolis, a new university of campus, mm-hmm. and in the middle of it underneath your library is 1 square inch of land owned by somebody else. Do you say you could force them to rip down the entire development to vindicate his property right in the inch? And we would tell him to go stuff it in so many words, right? That's what's going on here. But now, of course, that's what the open source problem is. You have 2 lines of open source code and a thing that cost you millions of dollars to prepare. We're going to tell you to go stuff it if you think that that entire thing belongs in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, and this is the famous eBay injunction question, which was decided a year ago,
mm-hmm.
is the basic rule should be that of real property. When somebody trespasses on your land, what happens is we give you an injunction. But when you go back to the real property rules, even though they didn't, quote unquote, balance the public interest, which is all the rage and a very dangerous conception, they did understand you don't get injunctions for innocent infringements of tiny portions of land where huge investments have been made under circumstances of manifest good faith. So you encroach by an inch, you can't rip the building down. You do it by a foot, maybe you can. Now, why the difference?
Mm-hmm.
Because the inch is within the realm of experimental error on the surveying stuff or measurement error, and the foot is not. And so what do you tell people? Well, you tell them 2 things. One is that you set it back more than an inch so as to be just sure that the ruler hasn't wobbled. And secondly, if it's appropriate, you figure out who your neighbor is and buy essentially in advance for a very modest sum a right to purchase the remaining land at a particular price if it turns out that you infringe. Say your building happens to tilt a little bit so that 40 feet up it's over somebody's space. You don't want to be in a holdout situation. And, you know, you can do that in certain circumstances, but you cannot do it in the open source case if, in fact, it's inadvertent inclusion, because IP stuff has much weaker boundaries associated with it, and no system of public notification is going to be nearly as good as a fence.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to relax the injunctions at the edge. This gives essentially the compulsory license people 2% of the pie. But it doesn't give them 50% of the pie. And that's what one has to understand, why it is that in all these cases, there are always exceptions, documentary films, but that the exceptions can be bounded for real reasons, tiny fractions, no new sources of supply, which mean that the current really important stuff having to do with new material and new innovation is largely governed by traditional common law property rules that were developed in, you know, Roman times or in 1400 AD with respect to land.
The final question I'll have for you in about the 3 minutes we have is kind of the overarching question, which is the general operation of the intellectual property regime today. There's a lot of criticism of copyright law. There's a lot of criticism of the operation of patent law with respect to software patents, business method patents, injunctions, and what have you. We don't have the time on the show, obviously, to get into all of them. But perhaps as an overarching theory, my question is this. You suggest suggest in your report that you think, by and large, the IP regime has struck the right balance.
Yep.
But to the extent that you would call for a couple of major reforms of the intellectual property regime, whether they be patent, trademark, trade secret, or copyright, what are the two major changes you would focus on to improve the regime as you see it should be improved?
I mean, first of all, one is, I think, is textual, that we've already talked about. Mm-hmm. You got to get the length period correct. Mm-hmm. If you correct that, virtually all the other mistakes become second order effects. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you could do with relative clarity. Too long in copyright, too short in patent is not a bad way to go. All right. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. Second thing is, on the patent side, the system of public administration is really very different from what it is on the copyright side. Copyrights, you just file and forget. And essentially, people can read and figure out whether it's a direct or literary infringement or whether or not, and then there's more litigation over whether or not there's an indirect infringement. You can't stop that. Mm-hmm. But in the patent stuff, there is real question as to whether or not the patent office is sufficiently funded. Right now, what happens is Congress tends to treat this as a profit-making operation, siphons the revenues from fees and puts them into the general treasury. This is, of course, a classic illustration of political short-sightedness, the likes of which only the Democrats and the Republicans jointly in their ignorance can manufacture. What we need to do is not take the money out of the system, but probably have direct public expenditures and put it into the system so as to get more reliable determinations at the front end and more rapid disposition of particular cases as well. And once you do that, that means that the amount of litigation goes down, the amount of productive activity increases. That productive activity will be commercial. That will generate tax revenues, and we'll pay a thousandfold for the sort of nickel and dime short-sightedness of our political institution. So what we really need to do is to have a collective anti-lobotomy legislation with respect to people in politics. And what it means is, and this is the laissez-faire.
That's a real intrusion on people's rights and freedoms.
You're damn right it is. But these are only for elected officials, and they have to forfeit. Things. And it's a simple proposition. Most politicians go one step forward to see the people who get hurt or lost on one side or gained by a particular thing. They never take the systematic overview and realize that the indirect effects of changes in these regimes will, in many cases, dominate the direct effects. So this applies to protective tariffs. It applies to outsourcing. It applies to intellectual property. It applies to things like the minimum wage laws and so forth. And if you really went back to Aaron Director and Adam Smith and realize that the presumption should be against more government, we could pension off many of the staffers who work on the Hill so that they can engage in useful lives and then strengthen the government actions that are actually good. And why is the patent office so important? Because whereas most regulation destroys property rights in a senseless fashion, this is stuff which actually, if done correctly, could create them in ways that would unleash them for the public benefit.
Well, Richard, I will invite you back, and next time I'd ask you to not mince your words and
okay.
just be direct. I'm kidding, of course. Thank you so much for being here today and for a wonderful discussion and for benefiting the listeners of the show with your thoughts on the state of intellectual property. I do seriously invite you back in the future. And
we'll do it again.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Okay, take care. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I want to thank Professor Richard Epstein for being on today and discussing his views of intellectual property and technology. It's always exciting to have someone whose work has influenced your own work on a show like this. So thank you, Richard, for being here. I'm looking forward to the next few upcoming guests after today's show. Professor Eric Goldman from Santa Clara Law School will be on to discuss his views of trademark regulation and also the general regulatory scheme that exists, a view which is different in some respects, although in many respects very similar to those of Professor Epstein. And then towards the end of the month, Professor Josh Lerner from Harvard Business School, who wrote a very interesting book called Innovation and Its Discontents about the Patent System. So I'm very excited to have those guests on as well. As always, you can hear this show by logging on to hearsayculture.com, where you can find the podcast. You can also go to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And as always, we're also on iTunes. If you type Center for Internet and Society in the podcast search, you'll be able to find the show there. So thank you very much for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Please stay tuned for Mike and Baptism of Solitude. And I look forward to talking to you next week. By the way, this show was being recorded on March 2nd. So the show will make its way to the air, relatively soon. But, look forward to talking to you next week. Bye bye.